Coming up on today's BMW Motorrad Ride and Talk podcast, customizing our motorcycles using both time-honored techniques and cutting-edge technologies. Take a listen. Over the years, I've had the privilege of riding BMW motorcycles all over the world. And the one thing I've come away with is that the only thing more extraordinary than the ride are the people you meet along the way. These are their stories. My name is Sean Thomas, and this is BMW Motorrad's Ride and Talk.
That's what we want to empower, right?
To amplify or to empower this whole custom industry, you know, to... And there's, of course, customizers that say, you're selling parts to people, you're making a public thing. And they say, yes, we make it a public thing because everybody should do it. And then if you want to do a crazy 200-hour build, do it.
Yeah. Good for you.
Sure.
Recently, during a trip to Munich, we sat down with Ben Ott at Motoism, a company that specializes in custom motorcycle parts design and manufacturing. My producer, Louise Powers, and I were given a tour of their facility and talked with Ben about how Motoism came to be and what they offer. During this interview, Ben helps us understand how the process of designing and building custom motorcycle parts has evolved to utilize the latest materials and cutting-edge technology, and what this may mean for the future of customizing motorcycles. Okay, so what you have here today is quite a bit different than what you and your brother started out to do. Can you tell us what you intended to do in the first place?
Yeah, basically, in the first place, we're like having this kind of illusion that it's like possible or it's like a good idea to start off with building limited series bikes from the scratch.
Yeah. And I see, you've got quite a few bikes that are sort of, I don't know if you could call it them vintage.
Yeah.
Maybe. But bikes that are certainly not, you know, current models that you picked up and started customizing.
True. I think that's the base where you always start off, like vintage bikes, which give you more opportunity, more freedom to build what you have in mind.
Yeah.
And then at some point, also speaking all of my customizer friends, you're super annoyed about working on vintage bikes because they give you a lot of headache with everything. So, because at some point, I think everyone is going to come to the point that you're spending a lot of time and energy in restoration.
Hmm.
If you do a 40 Ferrari, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the point of the whole game. But if you do custom, then you want to have something customized, right? You want to start off with something that is kind of a good base.
Yeah.
And with vintage, you always go into the restoration first, and then the custom is alongside this.
Yeah, because it's more than just looking at the bike and coming up with ways to make it look a different kind of cool.
Yeah.
You still have the mechanics to deal with.
The mechanics, every annoying old rusty screw, knuckled out, whatever you find on the bike.
Sure.
That all gives you all the headache and then shortage of spare parts.
I mean, you probably knew this going in, but was it a bigger deal once you really started digging into bikes?
Of course, you know it because we're like... We didn't start like with our first custom bike, working the first time on motorcycles in general. Yeah. We did restoration and everything like with vintage stuff before.
Yeah.
So we're actually coming from the vintage restoration. So this is our very roots when we started with 14 years, something like this.
Sure.
But you know it, but you don't expect that you're wearing out of energy doing this.
Yeah.
In our point, right? Mm-hmm. We want to be creative, do parts, do great builds.
Yeah.
And then at some point you figure out, okay, that's not really what I want to do.
Now, when you started out with this, it was just you and your brother. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. True. And you guys had day jobs. You were doing this, but had other
careers. Yeah. First time we were like, we were like doing, bottom down, 5 days a week, our Motoism, let's call it, back the day's shop started, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
And then we were like working as bartenders in our bar. Yeah, bartenders.
Yeah, that's
on
cool.
The weekend. So we had like 6 to 7 working days a week.
Yeah. And you described your first workshop. We're in your workshop now, which is really nice.
But
your first one, you said it was like the floors weren't even level. And you were...
Yeah. It was pretty... underdog place, right? And it was also like a big contrast, you know, you make the big, nice, shiny bikes, and then the other thing is like, okay, wow, what's this?
It was funny, you know, you have this bar set up where you serve coffee and whatnot. And it's really nice. And I remember when we first got here, I pointed out, that's a really nice bar. And you said, yeah, we got that bar before we had a place to put it. Like,
there was actually, we're like, you know, collecting this stuff.
But you were bartender, so that was important to you. You got to have a good bar.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. It's always good to accommodate people, right? To have like friends hanging out and everything.
Yeah. It's one of the things that struck me about this building right away is that it has a lot of soul.
Yeah.
You know, there's people in the back working on things. You can hear them as we're doing this interview. And you know, you're in this space that it just screams unique custom building location. Yeah. You know, it's really special in its way.
Yeah. True.
So you're customizing your first bikes and you're making your name as a customizer as best you can. But then you came up with this headlight assembly somewhere along the way.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that assembly.
Basically, it all started when we were like building our first bikes and we figured out that it's super hard to do something individual from the scratch, from spare parts. Mm. We had the opportunity or the possibilities to build our own, right?
Mm.
So we were like able to individualize our own bikes by building it our own with a lot of time and effort and money, of course.
Sure.
And then we out of this lack, what we saw, we said, okay, maybe that's our path, right?
Yeah.
Maybe we can do what nobody else is doing, or there is people, of course, that are doing good stuff, sure.
Sure.
But there's still room. There's still stuff I want to see tomorrow, which is not here today.
Yeah.
Right?
And this is the parallel between being a customizer and also having a business path that you're customizing as you go.
Yeah.
It's very interesting.
True. Yeah.
So you've got this headlight assembly. You came up with a design.
Yeah.
You built this thing. And it's not a simple headlight.
Yeah. The first headlight we do is it's called the CP1, Control Pit 1, we call it. It's like the combination of a headlight fairing.
Yeah.
And all your control units, including speedometer and everything.
Wow, okay.
So it's pretty hands-on. So you mount one thing, you got everything solved.
Yeah, I see.
And let's forget all the wiring.
So you had this headlight assembly that served as multiple pieces in one. And the installation process was complicated.
Yeah, it was very complicated. At the beginning we started, the learning curve was pretty steep compared to our today models, what we are, you know, offering.
Sure.
Everything gets better with time, right?
Sure.
So the first headlight was like a headache to mount in the shop, a headache to mount for the client. And then we were like re-engineering all the headlights and everything with this experience from, you know, working on it yourself, right? Only if you do it yourself and you see, that's difficult.
Sure.
You need to improve.
And you were saying like earlier that the headlight assembly is a lot of parts and just sourcing each of those individual parts is a very difficult prospect, certainly in a way that's affordable.
Yeah, true. Like in terms of minimum quantity orders, you need to have a stock of 100 to sell one to earn money.
Yeah, and that's interesting because now you find yourself in a position where you have to outsource all of those components.
Yeah.
All of those components are only inexpensive if you buy them in the hundreds.
Yeah.
And realistically, you're asking yourself, like, can we afford to have hundreds of that? Are we going to sell hundreds?
Yeah, are we going to sell? Or is it just money lying around in the... goods. Yeah, of course, we need to be.
Sure. I think that this is probably one of the places where somebody like you and your brother would stop because you go, this is a huge investment now. And, you know, from a marketing perspective, are you really going to sell all of these?
Yeah.
Yeah.
True. Yeah. That's rough. It's always like a thing. It's about a thing about gaslighting in a way. You need to check out whether something works or not.
Yeah.
And that's the whole game. If you know that it works, then it's sure. You got good cards, then you go all in, right?
Sure.
But if you don't know about the cards, then you better don't go all in.
I bet bartending was looking pretty good at that point. But yeah, yeah. So somewhere along the lines, you got shifted gears, and I think you mentioned it had something to do with COVID.
Yeah. Basically, we went into this shop, right? We started renovating the whole location, and we had our idea in mind how to, you know, to make our money and everything. And then COVID, of course, struck.
Yeah.
And then, we had to, you know, reassemble, rethink the whole process. And then for us, COVID was also a opportunity to speed up.
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, you had your work that was paying the bills as a bartender. I mean, that's got to be drying up.
Yeah.
Yeah. When it's 2020 and people can't go and have a drink.
Yeah. True.
And so somewhere you have to be asking yourself, like, do we go and find a completely different career, or do we knuckle down and make this customization thing work?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Basically at the point where COVID happened, and at this time we weren't working as bartenders anymore, but more in the engineering area.
Yeah.
But doesn't matter, the freelancer goes first, right?
Yeah, so, sure.
And for us was really the point where we said, okay, let's think now, what can we do, you know, to save our shop, to pay the bills.
Sure.
And then, and this, I think, also this need was also speeding up everything for us.
It's interesting because, you know, you refer to yourselves as engineers and freelancers. I'm
thinking or designers engineers. Yeah.
I'm thinking artists.
Yeah.
You know, because what I see around me, you know, you're creating some pretty amazing things and you're just conjuring up in your heads.
Yeah.
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 And saying, we can probably make this a reality.
Yeah.
So COVID hits and you buckle down and start really making this business go.
Yeah.
And you come up with a way to start making parts without having to outsource everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about that transition.
Basically with COVID, everything changed in sort of in terms of production locations, way you're producing your things. Overseas is not working anymore, right?
Yeah.
So you were like preferring to have like short production lines, best within your reach of, you know, 200, 300 kilometers. And of course we were like working on our production models before, but this was also a chance for us to speed up in terms of production, because all the businesses we were working with, they were like really grateful for jobs, right?
Right.
So when we said, hey guys, can we do 100 metal sheet, blah, 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 parts within the next 2 weeks, they would say, yeah, okay, sure.
Sure. So you've come up with this line of parts now, and we've seen a few of them.
Yeah.
And I'm going to take, for example, you showed me the turn indicators that go on the BMW R18. I think you make a version for the R9T as well.
Yeah.
And this is a complicated endeavor, I think, because the electronics on those bikes is not simple.
Yeah, true.
But you want a product that's very simple.
Yeah.
So how were you able to develop this and marry it to the bikes in a way that's easy?
Yeah. Basically, you have some part and you replace it.
Mm-hmm.
You have like intelligent system on the bike, right? That knows what's happening.
Sure.
So basically, you have like a resistor that's imitating together with the LED indicator what should be the output for the intelligent system on your bike.
Because the bike also knows when it's not right.
Yeah.
And if that's true. An indicator that's not right, it's going to say, uh-uh.
Yeah. You need to have a compassionate indicator.
Yeah. And I'll bet you went through a lot of swear words in German when you figured it out.
Yeah, you need to figure that out, right? And it's different on each bike.
Yeah.
Also here, right, we tried it all ourselves.
Yeah.
And then we figured out, okay, that's a hard thing.
Yeah.
We put a aftermarket headlight on an R90, right?
Yeah.
So the control unit says, no, guys, that's not going to happen. So what you have to do is you have to flash the control unit, and nobody wants to do this, you know, because it's a headache and it costs money and it's like... it needs to have some like hacker skills.
It's interesting for us. It's very common for us to get to talk with designers and engineers. Mm. And there's a big fascination coming from them about sort of the process of developing the product and all of the inner workings and how intricate it is and how much time it took, which we find fascinating. But we also know the end consumer doesn't care.
Doesn't care at all.
Just give me something that I can plug in and go.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. True. So, you know, like with your first headlight, it's like, it's very intricate and I can see that looking at it.
Yeah, but nobody cares.
Yeah, exactly. It's going to take hours.
Like a shoulder tap, you're a diligent boy, but nobody cares. Yeah, and it's like, that's the really the thing. Yeah. What we want to do is like, go to the shop. That's the indicator, like, that's my bike, 100% sure, delivery tomorrow. And, okay, no headache attached, mount it, plug it, play it.
Did you, as a as an artist, did you, as a designer slash engineer slash artist, did you find it difficult to create a product with all of that time and effort and have it sort of, you know, the end consumer not so much consider all of those things and just go take it, plug it in and be happy and go?
I think it's a process, right? It's like you see what difficulties you're finding in the process and then trying to improve all the time. So it's a constant process of re-engineering and improving.
So you came up with a process here at Motoism where you're able to develop parts that are not high quantity. You're able to make parts where you don't have to make 100 of them. But the price
we
still
can
reflects.
But we don't have to.
And you don't, you're not, because you can do that now, but usually the cost is really high. And if you're going to make 10 of something, it's hundreds of something. So you found a way to keep the production levels low, but also keep the cost reasonable. And I see the look in your eye, like the answer to how we do that is a little proprietary. Like, you probably have some trade secrets involved there. Is there anything you can tell us about it?
Yeah, basically what we can tell is we found an opportunity to use prototyping tools for serious production.
That's
the basic thing. And then it's, in my eyes, and I'm getting also like, you can see it, it's like I'm getting a little bit goosebumps. It's like, it's very much what the future can be about in our eyes or in my eyes.
The first thought I have about that is if I hadn't seen any of your products and touched them, you know, when I think of prototyping, I think of very fragile parts that really can't stand up to day-to-day use. But the stuff that you make is pretty robust. But you're still using technology that's normally allocated for prototyping.
And it's also like a transition, right? Because we just acquired a system that is describing this whole process from prototyping to series, right? Because it's a print farm. It's not, you don't need a farm for a prototype. So basically, you just look at something and then you test it and you work on it and then you figure out, maybe I can make my tooling or my machine make something that is even more stable than a normal polypropylene part that is coming out of a normal machine.
Another interesting thing that I found is typically when I see prototype quality parts, they have a texture to them that is very clearly prototype. And your product isn't like that at all. It's very smooth and clean. And I, you know, I can see from where I'm sitting, there's a whole pile of people in the back working on what I presume is transitioning from that to something. How is it done, if you can tell us?
Basically, what we are using is 3D print, and it has like carbon fiber. It's like a reinforced 3D print with carbon fiber. So that makes it very durable. And even better than usual products we have, like for indicator material. And this goes through a surface processing, of course, to provide the part for a final surface finish. So that's what we do. So parts of this process are, of course, like what we invented here, which are like a secret. Our like our you know, development. At some point, you come out with this indicator, for example, this headlight fairing, this windshield, that that's having a complete new shape, which you can't produce in normal production ways.
Yeah.
And as described, the finish.
Sure.
That is equal or better than usual products.
Just the idea of trying to create a part in a virtual space, like a CAD software, which I imagine is where you start.
Yeah.
Like that to me is so far over my head.
Yeah.
I have no idea how to get from A to B.
Yeah. Basically what we did in the first place was like, as everybody does, also as the automotive industry is doing it or did in the past, it's like you start with clay, right? That's basically hands-on. Our first models were always with clay.
Yeah.
And then you do the scanning and everything.
Sure, yeah.
And right now it's more like you do a sketch and then you start right away in CAD.
Oh, wow, okay.
And that's actually wonderful because you can create matter, right?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
That's cool.
That makes you like, a creator, right?
Yeah.
You create.
Yeah, I noticed your shoulders went back a little when you said that, like you, I'm a creator.
No, yeah. It's always important to stay on the ground, but just like, of course, one should be proud of what he's doing, but at a decent level, right?
Yeah,
but it's like the crazy thing to create, you know, you have some matter that is coming out something in a shape that wasn't existing before. And then also we had like all these questions in our head about being sustainable and everything. So now we said, okay, it's like... it's a polymer, right? It's also made from oil, right?
Yeah.
So, and then we figured out at some point, yes, it's a polymer, but we are saving tooling, machines, everything at a large quantity. So, when we do, actually, 3D printing is quite sustainable. That's an interesting part compared to previous printing.
Yeah.
And 3D printing seems to leave little waste in each of the pieces that you produce. Yeah. So it's a low waste product.
It's a low waste product. Yeah, that's true.
That's cool.
If you're me, you're going to make 150 variations of the same part because I'm going to screw it up.
That's true. You're going to have to find 150 people. Well, 149 people who don't care that you screwed the first ones up.
So the first time we ever saw anything that you made through Motoism was on, you had two bikes at BMW's Pure and Crafted. You had an R18 and you had a R9T.
Yeah.
And I understand that you went after BMW pretty hard to get your hands on an R18 to do some customizing. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, we had our first ideas about the R18 and the Pure and Crafted Festival in Berlin in 2021, together with Arjun from Ironwood Motorcycles, which had been our partner in crime with the R18, the manager.
Gotcha.
At that point, we just had the feeling, right, that this bike could be an amazing basis for custom builds.
Yeah. And did you know at that time that was really BMW's goal with the R18 is to give people the opportunity to customize?
It was a little bit, it could be obvious for a customizer, right? Because you see, if you see a bike and you're coming out of a customizer's perspective, then you would have like, okay, what's the clearance in the tail? What gives me headache in the front? Blah, blah, blah. What about the seat?
Yeah.
Blah, blah, blah. Do I need to cut? Whatever. And BMW did it really nice.
Yeah.
Like most of the bikes in the past two or three decades that they were like doing like mountings that were like with screws and not welded and everything, you know, and then you see, okay, they're embracing the custom approach.
And you have a customizer's eye. I'm sure you look at everything and say, I could customize that.
I could make that cooler.
Sometimes yes, sometimes no.
Yeah.
It's like I also, sometimes, of course. Yeah. In terms of motorcycles, yes.
Yeah.
In terms of cars, yes.
Yeah. Bartending? Did you custom drink?
I'm luckily done with bartending. I'm doing it in my leisure time for my friends, of course.
Sure.
And then if you have like a super nice Negroni or something and you know, do it with love. I think if you design a motorcycle, you paint a picture, do a Negroni or cook a nice dish for your friends.
Yeah. Well, you know, when we got here, you offered us coffee like 4 different times, which I really appreciate.
Yeah.
Now I'm starting to think like he makes some pretty cool custom coffee. Like
maybe you should have tried it.
Yeah.
There's some things you can improve.
Yeah. Okay, fair point, well made.
So if you have a Lamborghini Countach And then you put some custom parts on it.
Yeah.
I don't know whether this is the best idea.
Yeah, don't do it. Yeah, that doesn't need much. So we saw the R18 and you came up with some pretty unique parts for that bike that people can purchase.
Yeah, true. Basically, the whole approach about the R18 is like it, that you have like a headache-free 5 parts to custom kit.
Yeah.
Which you have 5 parts, you unmount some parts and replace them, right?
Yeah.
Or it's not, let's not call it replace them, but you amplify another impression of the R18 on the R18, right?
Yeah. And it seems like it's the mantra of a customizer to know when you're making parts for a bike, it has to enhance the look, of course.
Yeah.
But it also the quality has to be really, really good.
True. Yeah.
Because nobody wants to put a part on their bike that's going to make it look downgraded.
Yeah, true. That's actually fulfilling 2 goals, right? Is that on one point you, as a custom company or custom parts manufacturer, or however you call it, you want to have the quality level high.
Yeah.
And you want to have the people like mount some parts and then be proud about it, that it's really cool and it's really nice and it's durable and everything.
Yeah.
And then on the other hand, you need to think about competition, right? People copying your stuff. And for us, we are not afraid of copying at all.
Mm.
Because if you know how you did it, then the other guy at least needs the same time to do it the same way as you did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is your proprietary elements too.
Yeah. You found a way. I'm not afraid to talk about what we're doing here because it's like a hell of a work in the end.
Yeah.
And then for example, with our 18 parts kit, we're doing it from carbon fiber parts.
Yeah.
And also 3D printed parts.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to be OEM standard. So we're also working together with a OEM production company.
Nice.
So it's also, if you put the quality level high, everything needs to follow after this, right? Yeah.
You've got bikes here from several different manufacturers just sitting around us. And then in your workshop, you have a couple older BMW K bikes in there.
Yeah,
it's like you're tricking out.
Yeah, the guys are just preparing them to show it to you guys.
Oh, Sean, you and I get to see them.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I want to check
them out.
That's
exciting.
Yeah. Are those K75s or K100s?
K100s.
Yeah, okay. I saw one in there with some knobby tires on it.
Yeah.
Said, okay, now we're talking.
basically, we call them the Ultimate K.
Mm-hmm.
We just released one of them.
Yeah.
Basically, this is one of the transition bikes from old bikes to what we did on the R18.
Yeah.
It's like a vintage bike with a modern DNA, embracing the old heritage character of the 80s.
Yeah.
You know, that's important, right?
Yeah.
Because the 80s with the K100, of 80s is the decade where they made Star Wars, you know?
Wow. Yeah.
And then you look at the K100 engine. There's some Star Wars DNA in it.
Yeah, for sure. We worldwide, of course, we're from the USA, so we hear it with the US accent. But worldwide, we hear the equivalent of, that 1980s K bike is the best bike ever. Like, and we go, you know, that's a pretty exciting machine. Yeah. So it's pretty neat to see that it in your workshop getting
it. Yeah, that's the same. You know, it's like we do parts on the, we do a transition on the K100.
Yeah.
This is a long-term painful transition, right?
Is there any one transition on any model that's an easy one? I mean, they're all the R18,
I'm daring to say that if you dismounted the parts, it's like 6 hours mounting the kit.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's pretty reasonable.
That should be how every build should be.
Is that engineer speak, though, or is that Sean Thomas speak? Like, could I do it in 6 hours?
Sure.
You think?
I'll help you.
Challenge accepted.
No, but that's the kind of customization that I love, where I can get my hands on something and I can go in and it's relatively easy to mount, especially if there's anything electric, like the the indicator lights or something. I'm not so good with the electricity.
Yeah.
So when there's something that's plug and play and easy to do, and I can make this transition in my own garage, I feel like, I look at my bike, it's a little different, and I've done it. Woo-hoo! Yeah. That's cool.
Yeah, in my eyes, it's, I feel good when we do good customs and more important, do good parts, right? Mm. And this is like this we had it before, this kind of process of creating something.
Yeah.
But I even feel better if we can empower you guys, you know, out there to do your own custom project and be your own hero and your own customizer with... We said it before, like having a project together with your son or daughter or whatever in the garage, and then building your own R18 with a couple of parts, a kit, all plug and play. And then at some point, there's a lot of space for being creative. You can do your own paint job. You can you can cut it if you want.
Yeah.
We don't, if you want to cut it, cut it.
Yeah.
Of course.
Sure.
That's what we want to empower, right? To amplify or to empower this whole custom industry, you know, to, and there's, of course, there's customizers that say, you're selling parts to people, you're making a public thing, and they say yes, we make it a public thing because everybody should do it. And then if you want to do a crazy 200 hour build, do it.
Good for you.
Sure.
It's very cool that you're looking at both sides, like both platforms of that, because of course you're also making your own custom bikes that are just really cool. That's a cool side of it. But I think empowering people to be able to express their own individuality is a really special thing also.
It's cool. It's like at some point, you know, it's not about me, you know, or us. It's like people should be happy, of course.
What does the future for Motoism look like?
Future of Motoism, that's interesting. Basically, follow our DNA, do really high quality parts for motorcycles, do prototypes, do OEM collaborations, do prototypes for OEMs, do kits, and then redefine boundaries of customizing. And then our future is so interesting right now.
Absolutely. Right,
we have with all this technology coming up, the customizers 1 or 2 decades ago, they had far less possibilities.
Yeah,
of course, at some point it's also sad that doing your own fender out of a piece of sheet metal doesn't pay out at right now anymore.
Yeah,
you know, that's sad. That was possible in the past.
Sure.
We can cherish this in the past. We can cherish this in our private old-timer restoration projects.
Yeah.
But the future in another way is like more going into a machine direction.
Mm-hmm.
And then also to make it affordable.
Yeah, of course.
It's also important that everybody can do it. You can buy an indicator, buy the resistor, and then you start with it.
Yeah.
And not start with a 40K bike, right?
Sure. Yeah.
Making open to everyone.
Yeah.
And then, for me, it's the whole technology about production methods. There's new stuff coming up right now. You have like a printer in the mill in the same machine.
Mm.
Yeah.
You would like print a whole fuel tank, for example, or a whole car.
Wow.
Yeah.
With a nozzle like 4 centimeters.
Yeah.
You know? The nozzle is putting a thread, right?
Yeah.
Three centimeter thread. And then afterwards, after this is cooled off, then the same thing is changing the head and then it's milling out the form, you know?
Yeah.
That's what's coming up right now.
Yeah, sure.
So along with this, what we're doing right now, the 3D printing farm going from prototyping to serious production with printing.
Yeah.
New printing possibilities, new CAD, virtual reality, blah, blah.
Interesting. How can people learn more about Motoism?
People, they can, of course, visit our website, www.motoism-customs.com. They can visit our Instagram channels, basically they can just give us a call or shoot a mail or whatever, and then we're gonna, of course, we had been in the last couple of years, we had been really just in our workshop working, developing, and we're just starting to communicate what we were doing, right?
Sure.
Why should I tell something if I have nothing to say?
Plenty of people do.
Yeah. I think that's the difference between success and not success.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's a whole nother interview, I think. Ben, it was really good talking to you, man.
Yeah, thanks. It was a pleasure, as always.
Yeah. Let's talk again when you've got some more goodies to show us.
Cool. Thank you for your time.
Rock on.
Rock on.
We very much hope you have enjoyed this episode. We want to hear from you, so please rate, comment, and share your thoughts about this podcast. We have many more episodes on the way, so please subscribe, follow along, and share your requests for future episodes of the BMW Motorrad Ride and Talk podcast.